I'll try and speak quietly in that case. So anyway, we're working on the epidermis. The approach we take is genetically labeling a representative sample of cells and then tracking their fate over time. And then, as I said, lastly, I want to describe some unpublished work where we try and model not only the fate of the clones, but actually the whole organization of human epidermis. So the architecture of the epidermis in a mouse, and it's basically the principles are the same in a human, are that it consists of sheets of cells that are interspersed with hair follicles. And most of this talk is going to focus on this very simple tissue, the interfollicular epidermis. That's this stuff. And interfollicular epidermis consists of essentially of sheets of a single kind of cell called the keratinocyte. So there's only one lineage here. We're ignoring all the others. And we've known really for over a century that proliferation is confined to cells in this basal cell layer that's attached to an underlying basement membrane. And what happens when cells differentiate is they exit the cell cycle and then leave their attachments with the basement membrane, migrate upwards through the layers of the skin. They differentiate as they do so, and they end up being shed from the surface of the epidermis. Critical to this is the balance between the rate of shedding at the surface and the rate of proliferation. And if you're slightly off either way, you either get an ulcer or you'll get cancer. Of course, this isn't the only bit in the skin. We also have these hair follicles. And here, these include structures like the sebaceous gland, which is much hated by teenagers, but also just below the sebaceous gland, a subtle thickening, which is called the bulge. Now, the bulge shot to prominence in the last few years because of experiments like this. This is a genetic transgenic mouse technology to isolate cells that haven't divided. And in this work by Elaine Fuchs, and it's also been reproduced by George Kotsarelis, people found these cells which were quiescent in this bulge region. And they speculated that these would be stem cells, sorted them, and they were able to generate all the components of the epidermis, the hair, the sebaceous glands, the interfollicular epidermis, when these cells were sorted and grafted into nude mice. And a few years ago, it was maybe a tenable hypothesis that this bulge region was the master stem cell that supported the whole tissue. That's, however, been really robustly refuted by several labs. In particular, Bruce Morgan at Harvard published a very nice paper that really shows that these cells, these stem cells in the interfollicular region of the bulge, make no contribution to normal interfollicular epidermis. So the question that will preoccupy the rest of this talk is, how is this simple interfollicular epidermis maintained? Now, the usual answer to this, and you can find this in Legion introductory slides on stem cells and in many, many reviews, is that all adult tissues are supported by a slow-cycling, self-renewing, long-lived population of stem cells, which continually slowly turns over and maintains a short-lived population of cells called transit amplifying cells. And these undergo a set number of cell divisions, after which they all differentiate to make post-mitotic cells that will then leave the basal layer and migrate through the layers of the skin to be lost. I'd stress that this model requires that although stem cells only divide slowly, they do have to keep cycling to keep this compartment topped up. Now, it's very clear, not only from early studies, and there's an American biologist, Wilson, in the 1890s, who looked at the spermatogenesis and oogenesis of hookworm, and he beautifully described this model, but also in some adult cell types, like oligodendrocyte precursor cells, work from Sally Temple and Martin Raff in the 80s, that there are some adult tissue lineages which are defined by this model. But what I want to suggest to you, that isn't necessarily the case. So this model, in considering in the epidermis, it's been sort of proposed in the 70s that the epidermis would consist of beautiful hexagonal units of cells called epidermal proliferative units. And these would be clonal units in which a central stem cell supported a surrounding population of transit amplifying cells, and then you've got the postmitotic basal cells here, and this cell would support all the overlying cells in this nice column of regular shape and size. And the key assumption behind this model is that you can only migrate vertically upwards. It's built on the fact that the cells in the outermost layer in some regions of the mouse are arranged in beautiful cell stacks like this, and then it's argued that must mean that if cells only migrate upwards, that these are maintained by a single stem cell. Now, unfortunately, evidence for this rather elegant model seems to be lacking. This is a study done by labeling cells in mouse ear epidermis with retroviruses and then looking at what happened over time. And the predicted boundaries of the EPU are these sort of purple outlines of the cell stacks. And what you can see is that as time goes on, you get clones that actually violate the boundaries of EPU and actually seem to continually expand. And Rowe and Ranullo also reported an alternative strategy of genetic labeling, and they found clones that just didn't fit to this model, and also demonstrated that cells are moving laterally in the epidermis as well as vertically. So our reading of the literature when we started our work was really that the verdict on this paradigm of tissue homeostasis in the skin was at least unproven. So what we did, starting several years ago, was to try and figure out a way to just label a representative sample of cells in the epidermis and then track their fate. Now, apologies to those of you who don't like mouse genetics, but this is really quite a simple idea. You take a mouse in which all the cells would be yellow because they contain this transgenic construct, except for the fact that the expression of this yellow fluorescent protein is blocked by a piece of DNA, this stop cassette. Now what happens is if you cross this mouse line with another transgenic line that contains a bacterial enzyme called Cray, it will specifically cut out this stop cassette in the cells where it's expressed, and those cells will end up expressing a yellow fluorescent protein label. So this is a very simple on switch. Once you've thrown it, the cell and its progeny remain labeled forever, essentially. And the clever bit here is not this, which is the reporter strain, but it's this very tightly and beautifully regulated Cray. And the essential features of this system are that there's no detectable background recombination, very important for what we want to do. High doses give you very widespread labeling of the skin, but if you can titrate the doses of inducing drugs that you use to activate Cray expression down, and you can just label 1 in 600 or so cells in the proliferative layer of the epidermis. So the experiment is to breed a cohort of these doubly transgenic mice, treat them with drugs that induce the label in 1 in 600 proliferative layer cells in the skin, and then small groups of mice, 3 or 4, are sacrificed at each time point going out to a year. Now, to analyze this data, usually people cut tissue into very thin slices, sections, and then try and reconstruct what the clones look like from those. But we adopted a different approach, which was to lift off an entire sheet of tail skin epidermis from the dead mouse's tail, and then rebuild that in 3D using a confocal microscope. And this means we can capture the fate of clones at single cell resolution right out to a year. And what you see when you do this is something like this. We're looking upwards at the proliferative layer of the epidermis here. And we start off with no labeled cells, and then we see small clones that progressively expand over time and remain approximately coherent. What happens, though, to clone numbers is that by about 3 months, we've lost 90% of the clones we started with, because these cells in the basal layer will differentiate, and then they're shed from the animal, and actually only about 3% of the clones survive out to a year. And obviously we thought that when we started this, well, the short-lived clones must be the transit amplifying cells and the long-lived clones must be the stem cells. But we went on to do a more robust quantitative analysis, and we scored several thousand clones just analyzing those which retained a footprint in the basal layer, contained one or more basal cells. And I'd like to take you through some of that. And we're going to begin by just focusing on the clones at early time points from 0 to 6 weeks after inducing the label. Now, this looks like a rather boring histogram, but we're actually very proud of this because we think this is the first large-scale analysis of proliferation and differentiation in any mammalian tissue. This is about 2,500 clones counted at single-cell resolution. We and several other groups have looked intensively for apoptosis in the basal layer of normal epidermis, and nobody has been able to convincingly demonstrate it. So this really is a readout. We've counted every cell and every clone out to 6 weeks. And what you can see is that as we start off, we have mostly single cells, but then we get a broad distribution of clone sizes. And I suppose, being a naive biologist, I thought cells would grow 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, because that's what they do. And of course, this doesn't look like that. We have a whole continuum, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So that was the first surprise. When we look at some of this, is, for example, a three-cell clone, we see that it doesn't really fit with this STEM-TA cartoon I showed you earlier, because this little three-cell clone, which was labeled 3 weeks earlier, the single cell that founded it has divided, and it's got a basal cell here remaining in the proliferative layer, but then it's generated two of these differentiated cells, and you can see they've changed size and shape. And so within this clone, terminal differentiation is asynchronous, not synchronous as depicted in the cartoon. Furthermore, if we look for evidence of cell cycle exit, and we've stained these little two-cell clones here for a proliferation marker, Ki67, as you might expect, we see clones with two cycling cells and clones with in which both the cells have dropped out of the cycle. No surprise there, but most of the clones have one cycling and one non-cycling daughter. And indeed, we can actually look at for a marker of asymmetric cell fate, which is a protein called NUM, and NUM specifies asymmetric cell divisions in everything from a fly to a human. And this protein is asymmetrically distributed between daughter cells at division and confers different cell fates. And we do see within these two-cell clones asymmetric partitioning of NUM in these dividing cells. So that was the first surprise, but the real shock came when we looked at the behavior of these later clones going out to a year. Now, this shows you a typical example at 6 months. The shape is really actually quite irregular, the basal footprint. This doesn't look like a nice neat hexagon, at least. And whilst we can't count all of the cells in this clone, because once the cells terminally differentiate, they lose their nuclei. So it's very hard to count all the cells in this clone. But what you can score accurately is the number of cells within the basal layer. And that's what we went on to do. A surprising observation was how irregular the clone shapes were and how widely ranging the sizes were. Essentially, we have every European country from little Luxembourg right the way through to Norway and Italy in terms of clone sizes and shapes. But very crucially, at all time points in the experiment, when we looked for the expression of different markers, and here's the proliferation marker Ki67, but you can do this with a range of different markers, the proportion of marker positive cells in the labeled clones was the same as that in the surrounding unlabeled epidermis, leading us to conclude that we do indeed have a representative sample of cell fate. Now, a good model makes a robust and testable prediction, and the STEM transit amplifying model is a good model in this regard. So if we imagine that we happen to have labeled a stem cell in this paradigm, what will happen is that quite quickly we'll fill up this short-lived transit amplifying compartment with labeled cells. And then these will differentiate to make post-mitotic cells. And very soon we've got an entire labeled clonal unit whose size will then remain constant, defined by the rules that determine transit amplifying cell fate. Now, this is the first analysis of the data which we did as naive biologists. We just looked at the average clone size and we were able to draw a straight line through it. Now, that's very conflicting with this EPU model prediction, where things should really level off. And at that point, we thought, this is odd. We thought actually having a straight line was very odd, because straight lines imply simplicity. And we thought we need to talk to a physicist, so that's what we did. And the physicist, Ben Simons, who's a condensed matter physicist at the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, the first thing they do is they replot your data, and they use things like logarithmic scales of time, which biologists don't understand because they don't understand logarithms. But this is our cell fate data going out to a year. And we've plotted it so the black line is the 2-cell clones, then we've got 3-4 cell clones, 5-8 cell clones, etc. And just looking at this, we were struck by the way that roughly, if you look at where these peaks are, as you kind of double the time, you seem to displace the peak twofold along the time axis. And what Ben and his student Alan then did was to plot these curves against rescaled time. And what you can see is that late time points, there's an early transient behavior, but at late time points, all of these clone size distributions could collapse onto a single scaling curve. So that means the probability of finding a 3-4 cell clone at 6 weeks is the same as the probability of finding a 5-8 cell clone at 12 weeks, and so on and so on. Now, scaling is, I'm told, completely indicative, this kind of scaling, of a single rate-limiting process determining the clone size. So that would conflict with the stem transamplifying model, where we have two rates determining clone size, the rate of stem cell division and the rate of transamplifying division. So this is telling us that a single proliferating cell population supports the epidermis. We did, as biologists, check out lots of other parameters. We measured the diameter of the mouse tail over the year of the experiment and showed that tissue growth does not explain this expansion. We can't find evidence of apoptosis, etc., etc. But we really are constricted to a single critical parameter determining clone size distribution, and given that the cells are growing, this seems to be cell proliferation of a single population. The other thing that we know is that dividing cells have three possible fates. And having said that this model is incompatible with the stem transamplifying model, can we then go on to construct an empirical model to explain how the homeostasis of mouse tail epidermis is achieved? And the simplest model you can come up with, or we could come up with, was to say that all proliferating basal cells are the same, and they're assigned to one of these three possible fates at random. Now we know, and actually experimentally checked, that in homeostatic tissue, the number of basal cells per unit area is constant. As indeed are the proportions of cycling and differentiated cells in the epidermis. So it follows that these symmetric channels of fate must have equal probability, so that if you like, in the homeostatic situation, on average, we're generating one cycling daughter in red and one post-mitotic daughter in grey. So the behavior, this is the behavior of the population. And here we were then helped out by Charles Darwin's cousin, the great Victorian polymath Francis Galton, who's, I think, the only person who will ever have a Nature letter published on the best way to cut up a Christmas cake. There is actually one that he published. But the problem that we were interested in was this problem that he thought about, the very important problem of family name survival. So in Victorian England, if you didn't have a male heir to pass your wealth onto, and you were an aristocrat, you lost all your cash. This was very bad. And there was actually a literature, both by Galton and also by a French mathematician, looking at family name survival. And he examined this problem, looking at surname survival within a population. And essentially, the news is that small families are very likely to end up with all girls. So the family name is lost. Whereas if you get to be a large family, that's unlikely, but if you do get to be big enough, then you're going to always have a male heir, so your family name will survive. Now, obviously, the analogy here is that girls are post-mitotic keratinocytes who will be lost from the tissue, and males are the cycling cells that continue to support the clone. I don't do equations, but I thought I'd have to before this audience at least try and show one equation. So this is the equation that embodies this model. We've got a rate of differentiation, that's the rate at which differentiated basal cells leave the basal layer, and that's actually a function of the proportion of cycling cells in the tissue, which we can measure. So this we can dispose of as a variable because we can measure it. And it turns out that from the early time data that we've got in our data sets, we can actually work out the rate of cell division. And furthermore, from the long time scaling behavior of this 1 year data set, you can calculate the ratio of the rate of asymmetric division and rate of symmetric division and the rate of cell division. And so you end up with a zero parameter fit. And this is what you get, 8% of cells taking each symmetric channel of fate and 84% dividing asymmetrically. And the division time, 6.4 days, is consistent with past estimates of cell proliferation rate, which put it between 5 and 7 days. So here we've got the fit to the data, and it's actually not so bad if you run your eye along each line. This is about, these two are independent data sets, and we're running at about 70-odd independent variables, and we're actually fitting these pretty reasonably. And you can also do other measurements that we found consistent with this model. So our conclusion is that cycling basal cells are all the same, and in the mouse tail, these maintain the epidermis by behaving like this. Now, obviously, I've told you about these stem cells, which we know are located in the bulge of the hair follicle. This system will maintain a tissue in homeostasis really beautifully, allowing the stem cells to remain quiescent. And biologically, that's a good thing because it's a really stem cells are very dangerous if they go out of control. And this saves the stem cell the dangerous step of having to replicate its DNA with the associated risk of mutation. I know you will all get this, but for biologists, they often ask, how can a single cell type generate short and long-lived clones? So let's make this a game of dice. These two are identical proliferating cells. Here we got unlucky. We threw a six in our little dice game where six is two differentiated daughters. This clone is lost. Most of the clones will be lost in the first 3 months. But this clone is throwing away, starts to get a couple of ones, gets lucky. The probability of extinction through differentiation here is now much lower compared with this guy, and this clone has a good chance of surviving out to the year, end of the year experiment. This stochastic cell fate has other implications, and we were intrigued by I've told you that the average cell cycle time is about 6 days, but how is this distributed? Is it a normal distribution? And biologists simplistically think everything's in a normal distribution, but of course it isn't. Or is it actually stochastic? And the reason we were interested in this is very early data from Chris Potten and Robin Dover, where using a very primitive time-lapse technology, they actually had a hairdryer to maintain the temperature of the time-lapse microscope that they used. It ran for 17 years and then caught fire. But with this, they looked at primary human keratinocytes in culture, and they found a cell cycle time distribution, that's the time between one cell division and the next, that actually appears to follow this kind of distribution with a minimum time of about 12 hours and then a stochastic length of cell cycle time. I think it's a gamma distribution, but I'm going to keep quiet. It's actually, this is published in a paper in Physical Review E by Alan Klein, so you can go into the details there very thoroughly. But essentially, this distribution is incompatible with our 0 to 6 week cell fate data. The normal distribution can't be fitted, but the stochastic distribution fits really rather well. So our conclusion is that this is the kind of cell cycle time distribution that we're seeing from our data. Now, this is actually quite important for stem cell biology because one of the tests of being a stem cell, according to the stem transit amplifying model, is you're slowly cycling, and people then do what's called a label retaining cell assay, where they load cycling cells with a label and then say, if you retain label at a long period of time, you must be a stem cell. And it was reported in the past that in mouse tail epidermis, 1% of the cells in the interfilic epidermis were stem cells because they retained label. And of course, if with this cell cycle time distribution, it actually turns out that 1% of basal cells haven't divided by chance at 30 days. So if you do a 30-day label retaining assay, you're simply looking at the tail of this distribution, and the cell that retains label is exactly the same cell that population that can divide early. So you can't use a label retaining cell assay unless you know the dynamics of the tissue in which you want to apply it. And you need to know how the cell cycle times are distributed to use that assay. Lastly, what about clone shape? Because we see these sort of, if you look at the basal layer footprint of these clones, it's often slightly fragmented, but essentially they stay broadly cohesive. Now, if cells were able to diffuse freely but slowly in the basal layer, these clones would not cohere. What this is actually telling us, and this is, again, some more work of Alan Klein published this year, is that cells only divide when space for them to do so is created by a nearby cell exiting the basal layer and differentiating. And indeed, you can also explain the distribution of cycling cells, which conforms to something called the Votor model, which I'm sure the physicists here will recognize, using this kind of very simple modeling. So this is the conclusion, really, of this part of the talk. And I would say that these models are not only descriptive, but they're predictive. So we did experiments where we treated epidermis with drugs for 2 weeks and then asked the model whether it could predict what would happen in 6 months, and you get the right answer. That's with drugs like retinoids. They also apply to other tissues. I mean, the fit with the mouse esophagus, I haven't got time to show you this, but the mouse esophagus is very like the skin, but it doesn't have any hair follicles. And this model, again, beautifully describes homeostasis in mouse esophagus. So what about humans? Now, humans are not mice, obviously, but actually that's very true for the arrangement of the interfollicular epidermis. The great thing about human skin, which you can't or couldn't till very recently do in the mouse, is that you can grow it. And this is actually a sheet of human skin that was generated by a single cell. And what's good about these human epidermal cultures is that you can take skin like this and use it to treat badly burnt patients. So if you have a 70% burn, you might survive as a complication of being burnt so badly, but you haven't got enough normal skin to graft to replace what's been lost. So you've got a 20% gap. And what it's been possible to do is to take small pieces of skin, human skin, put them into culture, and then generate new human epidermis and put it back onto usually these badly burnt children, and then save the patient through expanding their own skin in vitro and then putting it back onto them. Now, the great thing about that cultured skin is it remains normal. The patients don't get skin cancer, and the skin, the cultured skin, maintains itself. You know this because you can take skin from the sole of the foot and put it onto other sites, and it retains sole-of-the-foot kind of proteins, so you know that it's the grafted skin that survives. And that's really very strong evidence that human skin cultures contain normal stem cells. And drawing on this, Jan Barenden in Howard's Green Lab in Harvard in the 80s did a very tedious but important experiment where he took single cells, single keratinocytes, and placed them into culture. And he found that he saw three kinds of clones. Big clones, two kinds of big clones here, and very small, almost barely visible clones. He then did subcloning experiments, and he showed that these two guys had very high proliferative potential, whereas this kind of clone produced hardly any progeny. And whereas one of these can never generate one of those, this kind of clone can generate both these and these. And he gave these slightly confusing names called holoclones, mericlones, and paraclones, but it's clear that there is, in human interfollicular epidermis, unlike the mouse, very robust evidence for the presence of both stem cells and these cells, which are clearly not stem cells in their clonogenic potential. And then in my PhD studies with Fiona Watt, I spent several years looking at the problem of trying to isolate these cells that make the very large clones. And this slide just summarizes about 5 years of work, and it says that in human epidermis, if you look for stem cell markers, the stem cell markers are found clustered together in these little clusters here. This is human scalp epidermis. So these are expressing a high level of marker, low level of marker, high, low, high, low. So it appears that cells expressing stem cell markers are clustered. And if you take the ones with a high level of stem cell marker, they form these nice colonies in a dish, but also you can go on and take those, graft them onto a mouse, and you get a new skin in the mouse. If you take the ones that have a lower level of stem cell marker, they really hardly form any colonies at all, and you can't get new skin out of that population. So human epidermis would appear to contain clusters of stem cells interspersed with clusters of other cells. Now, I might be foolhardy here, but I wanted just to show you what this looks like if we go to more modern imaging. And this is a 3D reconstruction of human breast skin imaged on a confocal microscope. And what we can do is slowly turn this around. And this is a green stem cell marker. And what's quite striking here, if we look for the red dots, and they might not project very well, but the red dots are the cycling cells, is that the red dots, the cycling cells, lie outside of these cells expressing clusters of stem cell markers. So we have clustered, quiescent, non-proliferating stem cells as islands floating in a sea where some cells are cycling. And some cells have differentiated. Now, what's remarkable is about human skin, as I said, is that you can culture it. And this is a culture which we call an organotypic culture, where we can essentially make a pretty faithful copy of normal skin. But there aren't any other cell types here. This is just keratinocytes. There are no fibroblasts. There are no blood vessels. There's nothing like that. And then we can ask, well, what happens to the patterning? And remarkably, you can reconstitute the pattern in the culture. And you can see here in the normal skin that these clusters lie on top of these structures called dermal papillae. These are the clusters up here, and the basement membrane wobbles up and down. But here, even on flat plastic, no other cell type in sight, we've actually been able to recapitulate the pattern. Now, that observation is very striking. I've summarised here where we've got to so far with humans, but what this raises is the question of whether a simple set of rules about the collective behaviour of the keratinocyte population can explain this patterning phenomenon in vitro. So an obvious question that this raises is, does the human epidermis contain a committed progenitor compartment, this cells behaving like the mouse rule? So it has the clustered stem cells, but are the cells in between doing this? I haven't got time to show you the data, but we've got quite robust data now that supports this. And indeed, this model would also explain a perplexing observation, where if you take human skin, label it with viruses, and then graft it onto a nude mouse and wait 6 months, you find long-lived clones that don't only arise from where the stem cells are up here, but long-lived clones also arise from the rest of the epidermis. Now, that's not a surprise, because I've already shown you that in the mouse epidermis, you can get clones that last a year from cells playing these committed progenitor stochastic rules. So what are the rules, the minimal set of rules we need to explain this phenomenon? And we thought, well, we would expect stem cells to both self-renew and differentiate, and there's actually abundant evidence for that from the in vitro literature. And I haven't got time to show you the data, but we're very confident now that the non-stem progenitor cells in human epidermis are behaving like this. I've also shown you from the analysis of clone shape before in the mouse in vivo, that I think it's reasonable to argue that cells only divide when the local cell density falls through a cell leaving the basal layer through differentiation. And we also know experimentally, because it turns out that several stem cell markers are markers that are of proteins that mediate cell-to-cell cohesion, that stem cells prefer to stick to each other rather than stick to a committed progenitor or a post-mitotic basal cell. So stem cells cohere. Now, if stem cells cohere, you kind of have a problem, and in previous models of the epidermis, this was recognized. But then, of course, what will happen is that you'll get a continent of stem cells that will grow ever larger and larger and larger as the system runs. If, however, as we know is the case, actually there is a low rate of stem cell differentiation in vivo, this committed progenitor population is very slightly out of balance in vivo, then it follows that what could occur is that the stem cell islands, once they got above a critical size, could start to accumulate differentiated cells within them, these committed progenitors, and then this could lead to the clusters fragmenting. And so you end up with a fragmented, irregular distribution of stem cell islands. Now, this sounds like a kind of conference bar argument, and of course, what we then wanted to do is to see whether this could be embodied in a physical model. And what Alan Klein did, drawing on the techniques of soft matter physics, is to construct a coarse-grained, low-resolution hydrodynamic model of the epidermis, simply embodying those qualities that I've just described to you. And it turns out that over a wide range of initial conditions, the average behavior of the clusters is as shown here. We get stem cell islands, and this pink C is just the committed progenitors in red, and the gray postmitotic cells. And this turns out to be, as I said, very robust. If you then embody that as the data from that in a cellular automaton simulation, you can actually get something that's extremely similar to what you see in vivo. Why bother doing this? Well, the reason you bother is then it emerges that patterning is a signature of stem cell behavior. If you vary the stem cell differentiation rate, as shown here, you hugely change the stem cell pattern. And this is a very robust and testable prediction, because what we can now do is attack our poor little cultures of human epidermis with drugs and RNAi constructs that we know change cell fate, and ask what the readout is in terms of stem cell behavior, remembering that these aren't stem cells just plonked in a dish. These are on their own in clonal culture. These are stem cells within an organotypic context who should be behaving much like the normal tissue. So I hope I've been able to convince you that clonal analysis leads us to believe that a very simple set of rules can explain epidermal homeostasis, and indeed the ability of stem cells to self-assemble their niche in vitro. And I say a niche because the niche of an epidermal stem cell is the surrounding cluster of epidermal stem cells. Patterning, the pattern that we see is a signature of stem cell behavior, and we can now use these kind of hydrodynamic models to make very definite predictions and test them. And just to conclude by thanking people. So Ben is my physics collaborator along with his student Alon, David, Melanie, Gosday, and Esther and Barbara are spending untold hours in the confocal room. And particularly like to thank Liz Clayton, who spent 3 years counting clones when we didn't know that it would work out as a nice, pretty model. So it's a huge tribute to her that we've got anywhere with this work. So thanks very much.